You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Carolyn Custis James, speaks internationally at conferences, churches, colleges, and seminaries. An adjunct faculty member at Biblical Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Carolyn blogs at carolyncustisjames.com. Her books include The Gospel of Ruth, Half the Church, and Maelstrom. In 2013, Christianity Today named her one of 50 evangelical women to watch. Her new book is Finding God in the Margins, The Book of Ruth. Carolyn, welcome back on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, people may have noticed in your intro there, this is your second book on the Book of Ruth. What is it about the Book of Ruth that draws you to it?
Oh, the Book of Ruth has been life-changing for me, and I did not see that coming. I think we can get really accustomed to certain stories in the Bible, and they sort of stay stories that are removed from our own lives. And all of that changed when I started hearing the latest research on this book. It's typically taught as a Cinderella story where Naomi, the Israelite mother-in-law in this story, is her sufferings sort of set the stage for the meeting between Ruth and Boaz. And they fall in love, and she proposes marriage, and he accepts, and they get married, and she has a baby, and everybody's happy in the end, is sort of the happily ever after, which never made sense to me that you could lose everything that Naomi lost, and that just a few good turns of events would cure you of your grief. You know, the grief that I have in my life from people I've lost, it can blindside you in a minute, even though it maybe have happened several years ago. So that never made sense to me. I don't think happily ever after preaches. And what I learned in my first shocking rethink of the Book of Ruth was that scholars were starting to call Naomi a female Job. And that changes the whole book. And but that was just the beginning. And the Book of Ruth keeps, for me, it just keeps on giving. I live in that book. And I can't think of a more relevant book of the Bible, especially in today's world, than the Book of Ruth. I mean, this is what shocks me about it, because the biggest shock wasn't even that Naomi is a female Job. The biggest shock for me was that this young woman who comes from Jordan, that's what Moab would be, into Bethlehem is, I mean, she's like a zero in that culture. I mean, it's like, it makes me think of Elijah, the story of Elijah, when he's in competition with the worshipers of Baal, and he pours all these barrels of water on an altar he's asking God to set fire to. And she's kind of like that, you know, let's just stack the deck against her and make it as impossible for her to have a significant place in the biblical story. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, when we read the Bible, we aren't reading an American book. This isn't in a Western culture. And if we just look at it through Western eyes, we'll never, ever understand the power of it. But it's against the backdrop of a patriarchal culture where women don't have voice or agency or legal rights, and where the culture gives preference to men, and there's a quest for boys, where barren women in the Bible aren't praying for daughters, they're praying for sons. And you measure a woman's value by counting her sons. And both women in this story end up without any men in the family and certainly no sons. And Naomi is postmenopausal, and Ruth is, after 10 years of marriage, is certifiably barren. So she comes into this culture. She's a foreigner. She's poor. She's a widow. She's barren, which is like the number one criteria for an eligible bride. And yet what scholars were saying is that she is the leader in the story, that she is leading the action, that she is making initiatives with Boaz, and that he is responding to what she's saying. And, you know, when we talk about women in the church, you know, in the debate that swirls around women, you know, the women who come to the forefront as arguments for women leaders or for women pastors or for women, you know, doing anything that's classed as leadership. We look at Deborah and Miriam and Huldah and Esther and Priscilla and Junia. You wouldn't think of looking at Ruth, but when I saw Ruth as a leader, for me, it was like, it's over. If God would choose her to be a leader and move his purposes for the world forward on her choices and decisions and actions, then who am I to sit by and think I'm a spectator to what's going on in the world? It totally threw me when I heard that. I just thought, well, you know, what have I been thinking, that I don't have responsibility, that I don't have responsibility to speak up or to act? You know, it was a watershed moment for me. And, but the more I dig in the book of Ruth, the more all three characters just stand out as incredible models for us in how we live today.
You know, you mentioned the new research on the book of Ruth, and I think that some people might be surprised to hear that there's new research on the book of Ruth, on this, you know, really ancient text. Is that scholars finding out more about the social conditions during Naomi and Ruth's time, or is that scholars going back and relooking at the original language of the texts and what we know about what those words mean? What's that research look like?
You know, it's like any other field of study. We haven't learned everything that there is to learn about the Bible. And we sort of look at it as, oh yeah, I know that story, you know, let's move on to something else. You know, that Christianity and what the Bible teaches is something we can master. And when I came, you know, when I was sitting in a class hearing the book of Ruth taught, and I just sort of rolled my eyes thinking, well, you know, I know this story backwards and forwards. But, you know, they are getting new tools for biblical studies. Yes, the culture is a huge part of it. I think, you know, for a long time when we've studied the Bible, we've assumed that patriarchy, a kinder version of it, is the Bible's message. This is how God means for us to live. But if you look closely at the biblical text, the Bible is dismantling patriarchy. Patriarchy is the fallen cultural backdrop to the Bible's message. And that is a hugely powerful hermeneutical tool. You know, look at the story of Naomi and Ruth. You know, we have little sympathy for Naomi. We just sort of shove her aside as this bitter sourpuss that, you know, just fussing. And when you look at her story within the context, and even current events shed light on the text, her suffering is off the scales. The patriarchal culture gives a woman status and meaning through her relationships with men. And that means who's her father, who's her husband, but especially who are her sons. And you measure a woman's value in the patriarchal world by counting her sons. A woman's task, her contribution to the world is to produce sons to preserve the family for the next generation. And one of the most feared outcomes in the ancient world was for a family to be extinguished because there were no sons. And, you know, we read this desperation that women have in the Bible when they don't give birth to sons. And we equate that with today's struggle with infertility, which is agonizing. But it's even more agonizing in the ancient culture, because if a man's wife doesn't give birth to sons, he's gonna divorce her. He's gonna add wife number two or wife number three, but he must have sons. And you know, his stature in the community is at stake if he doesn't get down to the business of producing sons. So it's, you know, Naomi is, this is where today's world sheds light on her suffering, because Naomi became a famine refugee. And we know, you know, we know, because we see on television what is happening with refugees and how horrible that is. I mean, that one thing alone is enough to turn her into a Job figure. But then when they, you know, because they flee from Bethlehem. Bethlehem is in severe famine, and it's a prolonged famine. And they go to today's Jordan. So she's the other. She's an outsider. She's living in a refugee camp. And when they get there, the death that they are fleeing meets them, and her husband dies. And she becomes a widow. And in today's world, you know, widows in our country, some of them have careers, some of them are independently wealthy, they have their husband's life insurance policy, they go out and get a job. But in the patriarchal culture, a widow is totally at risk. And she is one of the most vulnerable, that's one of the most vulnerable demographics. You know, today in India, well, they used to burn them with their husbands. And now many of them, thousands of them, are put out of their homes. Their sons and daughters-in-law or their families find them to be encumbrances. And there was an article years ago in the Sunday Times in London, and these widows were saying, "This is not life. We all died the day our husbands died." They become vulnerable to poverty, to exploitation, to trafficking. Some of them are very young when they're widowed. And so that's Naomi's story. And then, you know, she's got double insurance because she has two sons. But her sons marry pagan girls, which had to have been a grief to a believing mother. And they go through 10 years of double infertility. And at the end of those 10 years, instead of a positive pregnancy test, both of her sons die. Naomi's at ground zero. And the things that she says, if you read the book of Ruth and you read the book of Job, there are striking parallels in the fact that they both are at ground zero, that they both say that God has turned against them, and they both talk about bitterness of soul. But commiserate and weep for Job, and we just give Naomi a brush off. It's just, you know, it's incredible. But the book of Ruth is about the questions Naomi is raising about God. You know, the key word in the book of Ruth is the word hesed, the Hebrew word hesed. And it's translated with a lot of different words in English Bibles, you know, love, mercy, loving kindness, unfailing love, mercy. And none of those words capture the potency of this kind of love. It's the love that God has for his people and that he calls them to show for one another. It's costly. It's sacrificial. It's voluntary. It is stubborn. And it's the heartbeat of God's people. And she thinks she's lost it. And God doesn't answer Naomi by explaining any whys or sending a prophet or a vision or giving a voice from heaven. He answers Naomi through Ruth. And but the book itself is about God and his unending love for his people. And Naomi's in a position where she does, you know, unlike Job, she's a woman and she's postmenopausal. She doesn't get to start over. And, you know, her story's over. And, you know, Ruth's is too, because she's barren. And yet, this is when the biblical camera zooms in and the real story begins. It's such a powerful statement of how God sees those who are in the margins, that now the story centers on two women, two zeros. They don't have any sons, and the real story begins. It's a very subversive story. You'd think that, you know, God would do the big things through the big figures, and you know, that it would be happening in palaces and on battlefields and in temples, but it happens in this story in the middle of hopelessness and in the margins.
You did such a good job there of giving a good summation of kind of the first act of the book of Ruth. But I wonder, for those who maybe aren't familiar with the book, or it's been a while since they were familiar with it, if you could just summarize real quick the rest of the book. So Naomi and her family, they leave Bethlehem because of a famine, and that's where her sons marry these Moabite women, but her husband and her sons both die while they're there. Naomi returns back to Bethlehem with her daughters-in-law, and then what happens from there?
Well, there's a point on the return where Naomi wants them to go home. And under patriarchy, they are legally obligated to her. You know, brides become the property of their husbands' families. And so she wants them to go back. It's the only sensible thing to do. There's only suffering and poverty and exploitation waiting in Bethlehem. And she argues with them. And the one daughter-in-law goes back, and Ruth refuses. And it's the turning point in her story where she clings to Naomi, and she clings to Naomi's God, which is just astonishing that she would, when Naomi's telling, you know, crying out at how God has wounded her so severely. And yet Ruth moves toward even a flickering light and clings to her mother-in-law. So it's a decision that she makes that anybody in that culture would find preposterous and astonishing. And so when they get home to Bethlehem, the only way that they can survive is for Ruth to go on welfare, really, is essentially what she does. And it's so she, and that means she's going to go out into the fields of Bethlehem and she's going to be a gleaner. And gleaners come through the field after the harvesters have finished clearing it and pick up the scraps. So it's a hand-to-mouth existence. And in Ruth's encounters with Boaz, every time it's not a romance, it's a discussion of Mosaic law. And three laws come up in the book of Ruth. And the first law is the gleaning law. And Ruth lives on the hungry side of the law. And the law reads differently from that point of view, because the letter of the law says, let them glean. And Boaz allows gleaners in his field, but the spirit of the law says, feed them. And she's asking for permission to glean where the harvesters have just cut the grain down, but it hasn't been bundled up yet. And Boaz gets what she's trying to do, that she doesn't want to take home scraps to Naomi. She wants to feed her. And he makes all of these different initiatives to make sure she succeeds in what she's trying to do. And at the end of the day, when she comes home to Naomi, she's bringing 29 pounds of winnowed barley, which a male harvester would have to work a half a month or a full month to bring home that much in pay. So it's like the mother load. And that's the point where Naomi changes, because she realizes through something as mundane as barley that God has not abandoned his chesed for her. And she becomes a chesed giver at that point. So the third scene happens after the harvest is over. And Naomi is concerned that if life plays out according to the normal way it goes, that Ruth will outlive her. And she will be stranded as a foreign immigrant in Israel, a widow without any male protection. And so she speaks of Boaz as a relative. She does not use the legal term Goel, which is the kinsman redeemer. And she sends Ruth to Boaz, who is at the threshing floor. And she sends her out in the dead of night to him. It's a plea for mercy. She would not be so cruel as to send her daughter-in-law to Boaz with the hopes of the birth of a child, of a son. She's not going to reopen that painful chapter for her daughter-in-law. She just wants her to come under the protection of a male umbrella. And you have to bear in mind that in the patriarchal world, that this is a polygamous culture. Boaz isn't looking for romance in his barley field. He would be dishonoring his family, because marriages were for the purpose, yes, of producing sons, but they were also arranged to establish relationships with other families that would improve your own family status. So, to find a gleaner in your field would not only be abuse of power, it would be disgraceful in that culture. And Boaz and Naomi both refer to Ruth as my daughter, and scholars are in agreement that they were both of the same generation. So he's an older man, but he's introduced into the story as a man of enormous stature. He's a man of valor, and he couldn't be if he had neglected his responsibility to the family, had not married and produced sons. There's a story of a Palestinian man in the 21st century whose wife gave birth to a baby girl, and then she couldn't get pregnant again, and he was absolutely desperate. He said, I am nothing in this village without a son. So, for Boaz to be a man of stature has to mean he had sons, and he could have been widowed, or maybe he had a living wife or two. But people who were the first readers of this book, or who were alive when this was happening, it would not have mattered to them. I mean, it sort of matters to us, but it would not have mattered to them. So Naomi's just looking for Ruth to be sheltered after she dies. But Ruth is not about to go looking for a husband for herself. She's still fighting for Naomi. And what she has in mind here is to rescue the family from extinction. And so there are two Mosaic laws that she talks about that are involved in her proposal to Boaz. The, you know, throw your garment over me is what she says to him. For you are our Goel, you are our kinsman redeemer. So the garment is a symbol of marriage, and the kinsman redeemer is about real estate. And both are calls to sacrifice. The call to produce a son for a dead man is the Levirate law. And the Levirate law says that if a man dies without a male heir, his blood brother is supposed to marry the widow, and a son born to that union will take the dead man's place on the family tree. So it's a call to sacrifice, because when you're a brother in a family and one of your siblings dies, your inheritance just got bigger. And to replace that person on the family tree means your inheritance will shrink back down to what it was before. So that's the Levirate law. And then the kinsman redeemer law says that if you have a relative who falls on hard times and has to sell his property, his nearest relative is supposed to buy the land and get it up and running. And in the year of Jubilee, that land will revert back to the original owner. Well, in the case of Boaz, he's not the blood brother, and he's not the nearest kinsman redeemer. But he tells Ruth that there is a nearer relative that has first rights, and they have to present this idea to him. But if he refuses, Boaz says, I will make sure this happens. So he goes to the city gate, and this is where we find out just how powerful a man Boaz is, because he presents the sale of the land. And actually what he does is he gives Naomi property ownership rights in a culture where a woman didn't have any legal rights and certainly didn't have inheritance rights. But he says Naomi is selling her land, and nobody argues with him. I mean, this is how powerful he is. And the nearer kinsman redeemer says, well, I'll buy it. You know, it's like it's a winning investment because there's no male in Naomi's family. So, you know, he would inherit it anyway, probably. And then Boaz says, well, whoever buys the land has to marry Ruth. You know, where does it say that whoever buys the land has to marry the widow? You know, he just pushes this through. And the nearer kinsman redeemer just says, well, it'll ruin me if I do it. And so Boaz steps forward and says, I will do it. And, you know, what it means is if she gives birth to a boy, then all the money that was invested in Elimelech's land will be inherited by that boy. And the kinsman redeemer's sons will inherit less because their own estate was depleted by purchasing that land. So it's, you know, it's a powerful, powerful story. And it ends with the birth of this little boy. And Ruth gives her little boy to Naomi. And God redeploys Naomi to raise the grandfather of the king. She doesn't know this, just raising a little boy, but she raises him on the theology that she learned in the school of suffering. And, you know, it's a theology that she passes on to him, and he passes on to Jesse, and Jesse passes it on to King David, and David passes it on to us when he says, "Surely goodness and chesed will follow me all the days of my life." So it's, you know, it's a, if you look at it as a Cinderella story, you lose sight of all of the ways that the players in this story are sacrificing. That Naomi sacrifices Ruth. She's giving her up for Ruth's security, and Ruth is all she has. And Ruth is putting herself at risk by, despite her barrenness, volunteering to give birth to a son. And Boaz is ruined financially by agreeing to help fight for the family of Elimelech and Naomi. It's, you know, it's the gospel. It's such a powerful picture of the gospel.
One of the things that I think about when you give that summation is that I think that a lot of the traditional readings of Ruth have really been read flat. And people do this for a lot of the Bible. And I think there's a real anti-intellectual stream that just says, just read the words on the page and don't read between the lines. Don't put it in its context. And that really seems to be a mistake. So for instance, you know, you mentioned Naomi being given land. Well, that could be, if you read that on the page, that's kind of a so what moment until you know how incredibly radical that is for the time period.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think even when we, even other books, if I think about, you know, if you read The Catcher in the Rye that was published in 1951, there's things that we even miss now because it was meant to be read in the social climate of 1951. But because we kind of, we're not that far away from it, we kind of understand how things work then. There are some things that we get when we read that. And how much more true would that be for, you know, an ancient book like the Book of Ruth, where we're so far removed from that time? It seems so important to remember that these things were written with express purposes for the reader to grasp on to the subtext.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think it works both ways, that we need to understand the cultural world of the Bible. And that's more than digging up ancient pots and, you know, try to figure out, you know, what some of the artifacts are of the ancient culture. You know, we can look at patriarchal cultures in today's world. That's one of the things that has opened my eyes to what is happening in the Bible. One of the books that I talk about everywhere I go is a book called Half the Sky. And that book exposes the plight of women and girls in the world. It is a disturbing read. It's not something you can just read in one sitting. You just have to take it in small bites. But it is Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Woodun have researched this and written, and it is eye-opening. But then when you go back to the Bible and you look at widows and what you read about what happens to widows in full-fledged patriarchal cultures, there's a whole different understanding of the radical nature of those stories in the Bible. Or you read about Malala getting shot because she's wanting to go to school. And then you go look at Mary of Bethany sitting at the feet of Rabbi Jesus in a similar culture. They weren't shooting girls, but they didn't educate them. And they felt it was a waste of time to educate them. And Jesus is making these bold statements about, this is more important than anything else you do as a woman. You know, it's when we read that, it's, you know, it's just no big deal if we don't think more deeply about the cultural backdrop and because we go to college, you know, we go to graduate school, women are professors. So it's really hard to get excited about that story, but it's radical. And, you know, all the stories of women and men in the Bible take on a whole new depth when we dig into that culture. But there's also a way our own culture sheds light on these stories. And that's what this latest book is about, because, you know, I wrote the Gospel of Ruth after I was learning all these things. And, you know, it was just eye-opening to me, and it was life-changing. And it made me angry because I felt like nobody's telling us this, you know, nobody's calling us out. No, you know, we can call out women who feel called to leadership, but we need to call all women out. And I think the Book of Ruth does that. It's, you know, your little girl is called, you know, there are no exceptions. And you know, that's what the Book of Ruth did for me. But, you know, recent events shed new light. I've already mentioned the refugee crisis and how people look at refugees and how, you know, oh, we don't want them coming here sort of seems a theme in our country right now. And then Ruth is an undocumented immigrant. You know, she's not a shining star that everybody's welcoming into their country. She's nothing. She's nothing to them, except that they can't get around the fact that she's made this radical decision. And, you know, women didn't have agency. She should have done what her mother-in-law told her to do. And she bucked the system. And she said, I'm not going back. I'm going with you. You know, women didn't have agency. And then she doesn't keep her head down when she gets out in the barley field with this powerful landowner. She didn't know him. She didn't know what he might do to her. And there's danger in the field. You know, he has to tell his harvesters not to touch her. And Naomi says, you know, go back and keep working with his women because he's invited you and he's going to protect you, because if you go somewhere else, you could be harmed. So there's danger in the field and in what they could encounter and what she could encounter. And then, you know, she goes to him at the threshing floor in the dead of night when she's totally vulnerable. And he could do whatever he wanted to her. And if it came down to he said, she said, nobody would take her word over his. But Boaz is such a different kind of man, and he is very powerful, but he uses his power to empower her and to fight for Naomi. And he makes sacrifices doing it. I think this man is the anecdote to the Me Too crisis, because he has enormous power, but he doesn't use it to exploit or to self-indulge, but he uses it. He acts like a man who knows that he's living before the face of God. And I just think he's one of the most astonishing male figures in the whole Bible. And we miss that, you know, if we turn him into Prince Charming and the guy who gets the girl. But yeah, I think, you know, that your point is so well taken, that we read so superficially and I think at a huge disadvantage as Westerners, because we're foreigners to the world of the Bible. And yet we, you know, act like it was written just for us. That we're the ones that are going to tell the world what it means.
Well, there's so much there that you said that I want to unpack. You know, I thought it's interesting toward the beginning of the story, something that could be really overlooked is it seems like in that culture, it was very taboo for Naomi's sons, their followers of Yahweh, to marry women who worship a foreign god. And did they even have explicit prohibitions from doing that at the time?
Well, there was, you know, after the story of the Israelites en route to the Promised Land, when they encounter the Moabites, and the Moabite women are enticing the men out, and it's really kind of a violent scene. But, you know, the Moabites, there are tensions between the two countries, and there is this history of how they've been led astray by Moabite women. So, yeah, it's so unlikely that God would orchestrate a rescue effort into Moab to bring this young woman out, and that she would be the one who leads the charge, who fights for this family that has suffered so much, that, you know, is bold enough to make these radical, brash proposals to this very powerful man of enormous stature, and that by addressing local family matters, she becomes central to how God advances his purposes for the world. They all three do. You know, it's just the odds of that happening are just crazy. And if we turn this into, you know, here comes this beautiful damsel into the field and he's so taken with her, you know, it just,
you lose it.
You lose the whole depth of it.
And it's so remarkable that, you know, here's Ruth, someone who worships the Moabite God, or at least did in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But she becomes, and you make a very good point to say that God is really the only hero of the story, but she does heroic things in the story. And of course she, you know, when she follows Naomi, she says, "Your God will be my God." So she, if we want to put our language on it, she converts, so to speak. Yeah. But it would, I think that's shocking in the context, because you would think that this book of the Jewish Bible would not make heroes out of these foreign women, you know?
Of women especially.
Of women, yeah, you know? Well, women at
she's
all,
not
right.
Like Esther, she's below zero when you bring in her pagan background and her, you know, in today's world, she would be an Arab, and she would be an undocumented immigrant. I mean, so where is that on the social ladder? And then to be female in the patriarchal culture. There was an article that came out last week, anyway, in the last few days in the Washington Post, that said that in the combined countries of China and India, there are 70 million more men and boys than women and girls. And the reason for that is that boys matter and girls don't count. Yeah. And so if you just can have one child and you have a girl, you've got to get rid of that girl because you want a son. And, you know, that little girls are, they're rejected at birth. Sometimes they are rejected before birth because of ultrasound. They are neglected, and some are just outright killed. I talked to a nurse who was in India, and she said that when a little baby boy was delivered, there would just be this jubilant noise of celebration. But if it was a girl, she said she would have to persuade the mother to hold
the baby,
little girl. Ugh. So it's, you know, for this story to focus on a young, undocumented woman who can't give birth to, you know, it's just insane. It's so subversive. I mean, she was totally under the radar. And the interesting thing, the thing for me in this second book is to look at it in terms of immigration and an immigrant status in a culture like this. I mean, she's totally an outsider. She's below the poverty level. She's on welfare. She's a widow, and her only family connection is an older widow, which is just nothing. And when Boaz is at the city gate, and he announces that he will take the responsibility of the kinsman redeemer and of the Levirate law, even though he's not the blood brother and he's not the nearest relative, the people in the community embrace Ruth. They don't give her a green card or extend a visa for her. They embrace her at the highest level in their community. They associate her with the matriarchs of Israel, of Leah and Rachel and Tamar. And they embrace her as one of them. And the women in the village tell Naomi, "Your daughter who loves you is better than seven sons." I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, it changed everybody is impacted by what she's done.
One of the things that I see as an arc in the book of Ruth, and actually in the Old Testament and in the Bible as a whole, is this idea that societies valued the group to the detriment of the individual. And so that's why you see, and you even see it today, where if there's a weak link in the group, no energy is expended on caring for that person. And they may even do away with that person. You mentioned in India that they would burn widows with their husbands. And it seems like part of the gospel is God, and even the Old Testament, you see God kind of pulling people in this direction where there's value given to the individual, and especially the marginalized individual. Mm-hmm. And I really have come to believe that, on Jesus' death on the cross, that was kind of a watershed moment for that sort of thing. I think N.T. Wright said, like, this idea of human rights was not thought about before the cross. But you know, in this story where you've made the case really well that really Ruth too, but Naomi, you know, there was no social value given to her. And the smart thing for Ruth to do would have been to go back to Moab, where she's among her own people. She's not a foreigner, and make the best life she can. But because of the love she had for Naomi, she stayed with her and became, you know, adopted her God, but still became a foreign refugee, an undocumented immigrant in that land. And then also the same for Boaz, where he kind of, with the power, with the privilege that he had been given, he chose to lay it down and to help benefit these people who had no social capital in the time.
I think he does more than lay it down. I think he employs it for others. And I think that's a really important point because, you know, we're right in the middle of all this Me Too, Church Too crisis. And male power is a big issue. And it's not going to go away. You know, how do you shed your male power? How do you shed your privilege as a man in a world that tends to tilt in favor of the men, especially in some cultures? And what you see in the Bible is that power is a gift, and that it can be used for selfish and destructive purposes, and frankly, it's destructive to the man himself when he does that. Or it can be used as a gift before God, as a trust, and a way of empowering and blessing others. And that's what happens in this book. You know, Boaz sort of knocks himself out in every scene to make sure that Ruth can succeed in what she's trying to do for Naomi. And for so for me, it is a redemptive view of male power. I mean, what kind of world would we be living in if men understood that their power was a beautiful gift that could make this a better world for a lot of people? And there are men doing that. You know, men who are realizing their potential for great good. So I think it's, we have sort of this thought that power is a bad thing, and it certainly is a test of character to have it, and we all have some degree of it, but to think of it in terms of a trust that comes with responsibility for others to empower them.
Well, I'm so glad you said that about Boaz. As I was reading the book, your book, I had never really immersed myself in the book of Ruth like I had when I was reading it. And for me, you know, I'm not particularly wealthy, and I don't, I'm not any kind of a leader vocationally, but you know, here we are in the United States in 2018. I'm a middle class and I'm a white man. And so I'm kind of at the top of the privilege pyramid. And so watching Boaz, what he does with the power that he's been given, with the privilege that he's been given, it was really inspirational. And Boaz really instructs those of us with power on how to live and what to do with it.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely astonishing. And even in the things that he says to her, it's countercultural that he esteems her for her character, for her embrace of Yahweh, for her bold and risky actions that she takes for the good of Naomi. And he uses the same language for her that's used for him when he's introduced into the story as a man Hayel, a man of valor. He uses that same language for her when she comes to him at the threshing floor. It's like, in a culture that values a woman by counting her sons, he's embracing a totally different value system for women. And then he ends up fighting for women in the end and giving them legal rights that are beyond the law. I think he's incredible, and he's a worthy study. I think you're right. He's instructive too, especially now in the circumstances that we're in, you know, where male power is being demonized, and that's because some have so abused it, but, you know, the potential of it is beautiful, and he proves that.
One of the details that I loved was that Boaz instructs his harvesters to leave stalks of grain for Ruth to pick up. And I just thought that was so telling, because he certainly didn't have to do that way. He could have just gotten, you know, extra sacks of grain and just given them to Ruth. And that would have made him look like a really good guy, you know, like, and would have really brought a lot of glory to himself, indebted Ruth to him more if he had said, "Here, I'm giving this to you because they, you know, I care about you," or whatever. But instead, he instructs his harvesters to just kind of leave a little extra behind, and Ruth picks it up, and he may be nowhere in the vicinity. And it was a way, I feel like, to give Ruth some dignity and to help her without giving him the most credit possible.
Mm-hmm. And he's inviting them to be part of what's happening there. You know, it's an interesting thing to look at that in terms of workplace ethics, you know, because it is the workplace that he's, you know, he's the boss and these are his workers, and he's restraining them from, you know, hurting her for trespassing into territory that was off limits for gleaners, but for him to, you're right, for him to invite them in to instruct them really to join the process is redefining the workplace too.
Well, I mean, for any pastor living out there, don't ever preach on Ruth again until you read this book. It was just really turned some things on their heads, that assumptions that I think we've had about the book of Ruth, and really puts things right in the right context. And I think the way that they were meant to be read. Carolyn, I enjoy every conversation that you and I get to have, and I'm so thankful for your voice. And so thanks for being on Seminary Dropout again.
Thank you. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,